the energy for passive transport is in the form of a gradient. Now, gradient is a real general word. It roughly means difference. A difference of in some measurement at one place compared to another place. There's all kinds of different gradients depending on what you're measuring. For instance, a pressure gradient, higher pressure inside a pipe than outside, is going to cause water to come out. That's a pressure gradient. Or an electrical voltage, what we call a voltage, is also a gradient. It's a gradient of electrical potential, a difference in electrical potential energy, measured at one pole versus the other on an AC outlet, for instance. So there's all kinds of gradients, but what we care about for today is a concentration gradient. Meaning that if you measure the concentration at one point in space within a solution versus another, if there's a difference in that value for concentration, then you have a gradient. That's all a gradient means. But I want to repeat something that's important I said when I just wrote this word up there to begin with. A gradient is a source of energy. If a gradient exists, it is a form of potential energy that can be put to work. And so the gradient, if it exists, is the source of energy for passive transport. It's not that passive transport doesn't require energy. You just don't have to supply any outside or external energy. The gradient is the source of energy. And specifically in the case of what we're talking about today, the concentration gradient. All right, so passive transport is what we're concerning with ourselves with in this experiment. And passive transport is called diffusion. Diffusion of particles occurs from wherever those particles are more highly concentrated to wherever those particles are less highly concentrated. In other words, diffusion is movement of particles down the gradient from high concentration to low concentration is what I mean by down the gradient. That's the only direction that diffusion ever occurs, down the gradient. Well, I should qualify that statement. What I'm talking about here is net diffusion, not movement of an individual particle, but movement of a population of particles in one direction more than another is what we call net diffusion. And so diffusion, which is always passive, diffusion is always a passive process. Diffusion is a directed movement, net diffusion, is a directed movement, meaning the particles will move from wherever they are highly concentrated to wherever they are lower concentrated. That's a specific direction, right? So it is a directed movement, even though it is driven by completely random motion, which kind of seems counterintuitive, probably, to many of you. How can random movement give rise to movement in a specific direction? Well, everything, every material that is above absolute zero, which is all real materials, the particles are moving. Even in a solid, right, they're vibrating back and forth. But we're talking about fluids here, liquids, liquid solutions. So the particles making it up are continuously moving. And that random motion of particles is called Brownian motion. So that's the random aspect. Each individual particle is moving at its own specific speed and in its own specific direction. But as a population, that's random. So how does that randomness then lead to them moving from high concentration to low concentration, which is a directed movement? Well, I usually try to explain this with just a thought exercise. We could actually go through with this, but we don't have to do it. You can just imagine doing it. If you get a bunch of volunteers, though, to represent particles, each human is a particle. Now, this is a two-dimensional example because they're staying on the floor, but in reality, the particles could go in all three dimensions. But the concept is still the same. If you get a bunch of people in a big room, like a gymnasium, for instance, and you stop the clock, no time is running, so you just set the thing up, first of all, by putting them up in a tight group in the middle of the room. So each of these dots is the head of a person representing a particle. You not only, with the clock still stopped, you just randomly face each person in some direction. That whatever direction the person is facing, that's the direction they're going to start walking once the clock stops, right? And they will continue walking in that direction until they hit something, and then they'll bounce off and go in another direction. So if you get people to cooperate and do that, and then you start the clock, most of the people are going to be in the middle of this group. And so it doesn't really matter which direction they're facing. They're not going to get very far, right? They're just going to bump into each other, keep bouncing off of each other, going in new directions but not getting anywhere. On the periphery, the edge of the group, some of those people will just randomly be facing inward, so they're not going to get very far either, right? They're just going to bump into... But some of them will randomly be facing outward. So when the clock starts, they're going to walk until they hit the wall and then start a new direction. In other words, they're leaving the group. And the more that happens, the more likely it is that some of the people left behind will be eligible if they're facing the right direction in leaving the group also. So if you let this happen for a while, and people are still doing it correctly, you come back later, you won't have a gradient. Right now you have a gradient. Right? This is a high concentration right here, a low concentration right here. Or anywhere other than the center is a low concentration, right? If you come back an hour and people are still cooperating, they'll be more or less equally spread out. It'd be the same concentration everywhere in the room, right? They'll be just bouncing off the walls at each other, but they'll be spread out. So at that point, there is no more gradient. But the gradient itself allowed for that directed movement. It's random movement individually, but as a population, they're moving in one direction away from the concentration, in other words, more than toward it. And that's how diffusion always works. There's more movement away from the high concentration than toward it. And that's the only direction that net diffusion can ever occur. Because if you're talking about passive transport, which diffusion always is, it's always down a gradient. Now, we're not talking about active transport here, or we're not performing active transport, but active transport can move things against their gradient, up the gradient. It can take particles from where they're already sparse and put them where they're already plentiful, which is exactly the opposite direction that they want to diffuse into, right? And that's exactly why you have to supply the energy to do that. It's never going to happen on its own. So that's the distinction between the two that... based on energy, active and passive transport. All right, well, let's look at some pictures. I said I'm going to go through three slides. Just remember, this whole recording is both laboratory material and lecture material. In this slide 10, on the top row, we have a chamber. It's the same chamber for all three. It's just in different times. And it shows you particles of dye, the orange balls. But keep in mind, there are also particles of water. They didn't bother drawing the water molecules. It's just blue background. But they're actually particles, of course, molecules of water. Because remember, there's two components, two major components to a solution, right? Which this is. There are solvent particles and there are solute particles. Well, here you have one type of solute, the orange dye. You have an overall chamber, but it's broken into two sides, two subchambers, by the dashed gray line, which indicates, or which represents, what is called a selectively permeable membrane. Permeability refers to the ability for things to get through something. To permeate means to go through. So a membrane can be totally impermeable, nothing's going to get through it. It can be freely permeable, which is not much of a boundary, right? Or it can be selectively permeable. That just simply means that only select things, only certain types of particles are able to get through, others are blocked. In this case, for this particular membrane, it is permeable to whatever the orange dye is. But at time zero, before you let this happen, notice that all of the orange dye molecules are on one side. They're all on the left to begin with. In other words, there is a gradient in place, right? A gradient for orange dye particles. High concentration on the left subchamber, zero concentration, so therefore lower, on the right subchamber. Well, a gradient you can think of as the tendency for diffusion to occur. But importantly, there are two things that are required for net diffusion to actually occur. One is that a gradient has to be in place. So that's the tendency, but a tendency is not enough for it to actually occur. You have to have it, but you also have to have the second requirement, which is there has to be a way for that particular kind of particle to get from A to B, or from high concentration to low concentration, which isn't always the case. Just because a gradient exists doesn't mean it can get there. In this case, it can, though, because it's able to permeate through the membrane. And so when you allow it time to pass, that's exactly what particles do. Each individual particle is randomly moving. So there are some particles. Well, at first, there are no particles moving from right to left because there are no particles that are in the right side, right? They'll all be moving toward the... If there's any movement to the right, that's all there will be. But as soon as you have some in the right, some of those might move back to the left individually. But simply since there are more on the left than on the right, it's more likely that there's going to be ones moving from the left to the right than right to left. And that's exactly what diffusion allows. It spreads out, and notice the word equilibrium here means, in this case, there's different ways to reach equilibrium. In this case, equilibrium is reached when the gradient is totally dissipated. In other words, when the gradient becomes zero. A gradient of zero means that there is no longer any difference in concentration at A versus B. Right? They're at equal concentrations. Well, zero gradient means zero tendency to diffuse in any given direction. It doesn't mean the particles will stop. They're always going to be moving. But when there's no more gradient, those particles are moving from right to left just as much as from left to right. So there is no longer any net diffusion, even though there is movement. That's what's illustrated on the top. The bottom is exactly the same situation, except there are two different solutes. Orange dye is present here again, but now we've added purple dye. And the important concept here is that if you have multiple different types of particles, each particle will have its own gradient that is totally independent of other gradients. And whether or not a particular kind of particle moves or net diffuses depends only on that particular particle's gradient. It doesn't depend on the other kind of particle's gradients. So there's only one reason here why the orange particles on the bottom are moving to the right, because that's the direction of the gradient for orange particles. It's going from high concentration on the left to low concentration on the right. And similarly, the only reason the purple dye molecules are moving from right to left is because that's the direction of their own gradient. They're high concentration on the right, low concentration on the left. So they always go down their gradient. All right? And that's the only reason they're moving. They're not influenced by each other. But since they're able to both permeate, that means you fulfilled both requirements for diffusion. There is a gradient for each of these, and there's a way for each of these to get from A to B. So they both do, and over time there's equilibrium of both of them. Now this particular example of examples of diffusion, first of all, involves solute particles, which are not the only kinds of particles, but also it involved permeating through a membrane, which also is not necessarily always the case. An even simpler case of diffusion would be the familiar example of just dropping a sugar cube into a glass of water. You know, the very first moment you do that, there is a very strong gradients. There's a high concentration of sugar in the cube itself and a zero concentration where the water is. So that's a strong sugar gradient, or a steep gradient, as we say, if it's a big difference. And there's also a gradient for water particles. Very high concentration of water particles in the pure water, as high as you can get, and a zero concentration where the sugar currently is. So this is just like these two things right here. They each have their own gradient. All right. So in this case, there's no membrane blocking them, and therefore they'll both also have the second criterion filled. They'll have a way to get from A to B. And over time, the sugar will leave the high concentration where the cube was originally and go out into the water. The water molecules will go from where they're highly concentrated to where the sugar is in low water concentration. But each of them is moving only because of its own gradient. That is just simple diffusion of both of those particles. This is also simple diffusion, but it's diffusion of solute particles through a membrane. All right? Well, there's also a special case of diffusion called osmosis, and that's what we're studying in this experiment today. Osmosis is diffusion, first of all. But not all diffusion is osmosis. Osmosis is a special case of diffusion. And it's a special case for two reasons. And only if those two things are fulfilled will it actually be osmosis. One is that for diffusion to be osmosis, the thing that is diffusing is a solvent particle, not a solute particle. In that previous slide, we saw solute particles moving. That's diffusion, but not osmosis. Osmosis is diffusion of solvent particles. That's half of the requirement. Now, just about any, if not every, textbook in biology will say osmosis is diffusion of water. And that's simply because in biology, the solvent always is water. But in chemistry, osmosis is defined as diffusion of solvent. It can be any solvent. Just in biological case, that solvent is water. So that's one requirement. The movement of the particles being moved are not solute particles, they're solvent particles. The second requirement is that those solvent particles are moving through a selectively permeable membrane. Now notice that's not true for the sugar cube in the glass of water example. In that case, water was moving down its gradient from water to sugar cube, but it's not going through any membrane, so even though it's a solvent, that still is not osmosis. That's simply diffusion of water. Is that clear? Okay, but if you have water moving through a membrane that is selectively permeable, water is able to get through but other things can't, then you have osmosis. Now, I think that most textbooks confusingly word the definition of osmosis. Because usually osmosis has a definition in a textbook something like this: movement of water from a region of low solute concentration to a region of high solute concentration. Have you ever encountered a definition like that? Or have you not even seen a definition of osmosis? It's often defined that way. And it's true, that is true, that in osmosis water moves from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, but that sounds confusing because it seems to be an exception to things always moving passively down gradients from high to low concentration. It's not actually an exception, though. It's just a backwards way of saying things. Because think about what low solute concentration means in terms of water. It means high water concentration, right? If you have a very low solute concentration, that means the solution is very watery. And remember, it's only that particle's own gradient that matters. It's not the solutes that matter to the movement of water. It's water's own concentration. So yes, you can say that osmosis is movement of through a selectively permeable membrane of water from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, but that's just another way of saying that the water osmoses through the membrane from a place of high water concentration to low water concentration. That's really what matters, the water gradient, not the solute gradient. Okay, that's a more straightforward way of thinking about it, I think. We can see that in slide 11. This is happening. This is a commonly encountered piece of laboratory glassware that, known as a U-tube, the original use of U-tube. But it's used here as two chambers. So once again, we have a selectively permeable membrane on the bottom. We have two particles, even though only except in the detail on the bottom, they still don't show the water molecules, which they should. You have on the left side water particles and solute particles, and the same on the right side, but notice there's concentration difference. This left chamber has a lower solute concentration, right? Okay, well, since there are two types of particles, there's two separate gradients that exist. There's two differences in concentration. There's a difference in green dye concentration, or this is sugar, I guess. There's a sugar gradient from right to left, because it's high concentration of sugar on the right, lower on the left. And there's a water gradient as well. In the left, the low solute concentration means more watery, higher water concentration. So the gradient for water is left to right. That's the direction it wants to diffuse in. Since it's going through a selectively permeable membrane, though, and since water is a solvent, if it does diffuse, that's not only going to be diffusion, it's specifically going to be osmosis. Okay, now in this case, selectively permeable matters because the water gets through, but the sugar can't. That's what makes it osmosis. So if you set this up and allow it to run, there's a tendency for both types of particles to diffuse, right? The gradient is the tendency. But even though there's a tendency for sugar to diffuse, it can't because it can't get through the membrane. Water has the tendency and the ability, so it does move through the gradient. That means you're going to be removing water from the left side without replacing it with anything. And you're going to be adding water to the right. So over time, the right side of the U-tube is going to get a higher level of liquid, and the left side is going to get a lower level of liquid. Well, this one is at equilibrium as well. And in this case, it looks like it came to equilibrium because, once again, the gradient came to zero. Because it looks like it's the same concentration on both sides now, right? If that's true, it will stop. Because zero gradient means no more tendency to osmose in one direction or the other. Water molecules will just be moving equally in both directions. But there's another way this could come to equilibrium without the gradient going to zero. You just have to imagine it, since I don't have the picture. Let's set this up exactly the same, except have no sugar at all on the left. It's just pure water on the left to begin with. So the gradients both still exist. They're in the same directions, but it's pure water to start with on the left. Well, water's going to move to the right, down its gradient, as it always does, passively. But since there's no sugar to begin with here, no matter how much water you remove from the left, it's still going to be pure water, which is still going to be higher than in the solution, right? So the gradient will still always be in place. You'll still always be more watery here than there. But eventually it'll still stop, because the higher you make this level on the right side, the more it's being pulled down by gravity, which is trying to push water back to the right, to the left, which is exactly opposing the osmosive force. Is that clear? And when those two forces exactly equal each other, it will be at equilibrium for a different reason, but the gradient will still be in place. There still will be the tendency for water to move more to the right by osmosis, but there will be an equal tendency for water to be pushed to the left by gravity. Okay, that's osmosis. Now we need to go to 12 for some more definitions. And just like the definition of osmosis, I think, is confusingly written, so is the definition for all of these terms at the top. The main theme of this slide is tonicity. Tonicity refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur either into or out of a cell based on its environment. Now, before I define these terms, I want to alert you, especially because the packets themselves, which is largely the stuff that was in the manual before, might get this wrong. I actually haven't read every word of these, so I haven't checked. But obey what I'm going to say to you rather than what's necessarily written in the packets. These three terms, these three degrees or categories of tonicity, hypotonic, isotonic, hypertonic, those words should never be used to describe a cell. Those words are only used to describe the surroundings, the environment of a cell, not the cell itself. So you use these words when a cell is surrounded by a particular environment and you want to describe the environment. Well, the environment is a liquid, that's a solution. And what's inside the cell is also a solution, right? So you have two solutions here, separated by a selectively permeable membrane known as the plasma membrane of the cell. And tonicity refers to whether or not and in which direction, if so, osmosis will occur through that plasma membrane. Now to the part that I think is backwards, or seems backwards. Each of these words has tonic in it, but the prefix matters, right? Hypo means what? Below. It means below. Hypodermic is below the skin, for instance. Well, remember what I said earlier. What matters for osmosis is the water gradient. That's what drives it. But these tonicity words use a prefix that describes not the water, but the solutes. So a hypotonic solution gets its name because it has a lower, that's the hypo part, a lower solute concentration than the cell solution has. Remember, these words describe the environment, not the cell. So a hypotonic environment has a lower solute concentration than the cell does, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution has a higher water concentration than the cell does. In other words, it's more watery than the cell. Is that clear? If it's more watery than the cell, then that means there's a water gradient across the membrane, right? By definition. And therefore, there is at least a tendency for water to diffuse. Well, water can get through the membrane, so there's also the ability to diffuse. And since it's water, which is a solvent, going through a membrane, it's not just diffusion, it's osmosis. If a cell, though, is in a hypotonic environment, that means water's going to enter the cell. In all cases, water's going to move down its gradient if there is one. Water's always going to move from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. Well, a hypotonic environment is more watery than the cell. That's why water's going to move into the cell. In the top row of this table, we have a typical animal cell, a red blood cell or erythrocyte, just as an example of what will happen in these environments. An animal cell, remember, has only a plasma membrane. It does not additionally have a cell wall. And the plasma membrane is fairly flimsy. So in a hypotonic environment, an animal cell does not do well. That water that's going to come in by osmosis is going to swell the cell. And if the gradient is too steep, or if it's too long a time that it's being subjected to this, then the limit will be reached for how much pressure the plasma membrane can hold, and it will burst. That is called lysis. Lysed is just the past tense of the verb, but the process is lysis, which we've already talked about means splitting, right? It splits the cell, bursts it. And I shouldn't have to tell you that that is bad for the cell. That cell dies. So an animal cell doesn't do well in a hypotonic environment. Let's go to the other extreme, which is hypertonic. This is backwards for the same reason. The hyper, meaning above, refers to the solute, not the wateriness. So a hypertonic environment is one that contains a higher solute concentration than the cell does, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Less watery means there's a gradient, right? There's two different waterinesses. That's a gradient. But it's the water gradient that counts, and water is always going to go from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. It's just that the gradient is reversed in this case. So water goes from more watery inside to less watery outside. Therefore, the cell shrivels. And that shriveling of an animal cell in the presence of a hypertonic solution is called crenation. With an N, not an M. Crenation, if it's drastic enough, also kills the cell. So the extremes are not good for animal cells. On the other hand, an isotonic solution is ideal. Well, the prefix iso means same. So an isotonic solution is any solution, regardless of the types of solutes, any solution that has the same overall solute concentration as the cell does. Notice that what that means is that you could have two totally different kinds of solutions, one inside the cell and one outside the cell. By totally different kinds of solutions, I mean the solutes are totally different types. In fact, you have that situation in today's experiment. But that's okay, because it's not the solute gradients that matter, right? It's the water gradient. So if you have a 1 molar sugar concentration outside and a 1 molar starch concentration on the inside, yeah, they're totally different solutes, but if they're both 1 molar concentration, that means they're equally watery. Therefore, there is no water gradient in that case. That's what isotonicity refers to. No tendency for water to go in one direction more than the other. So water moves both in and out of the cell in an isotonic environment, and that keeps it alive because it's not going to crenate or lyse. On the bottom, we have plant cells in the three conditions as well. But the preference, so to speak, is different for plant cells because they have a cell wall. If you put a plant cell into a hypotonic solution, for the same reason that water would enter an animal cell, water is going to enter the plant cell. It's going down its gradient. Water is going down its gradient to enter the cell. But in this case, you have that nice sturdy cell wall that can hold that pressure in. So it'll come to equilibrium when the pushback of the wall exactly equals the pushing in the other direction from incoming water from osmosis. Okay? Doesn't mean the gradient has been eliminated. It just means the forces equal each other. But that's going to mean that individual cell is turgid or swollen. A plant's body, though, is made of trillions of cells, not just one cell in isolation. And in an overall body of a plant, if it's in its ideal situation, meaning it's in a hypotonic environment, a watery environment, then it will have an erection. Because each individual cell is swelling, but they're all connected to each other and they're pushing on each other, therefore. So it's very similar to an erection in a penis, which is driven by blood pressure, more blood coming in than leaving, except that this is water coming in by osmosis and they're all pushing on each other. You know, it doesn't have to be a tree that stands up. A green, non-woody stem will still stand up as long as you keep watering it. When you keep watering it, you're maintaining the hypotonicity. If you forget to water it, eventually will become flaccid because the solution will be isotonic eventually. A flaccid plant cell survives. It's just not ideal. That's why it'll droop. And if you notice that soon enough, you can water it and it'll recover. A plant cell, on the other hand, in a hypertonic solution will die. If it's not watery enough, if the cell itself is more watery than the environment, which is what hypertonic situation is, then water is going to leave just like it did from the animal cell. But in this case, the water is contained inside the plasma membrane, and when you lose it from there, that's going to cause the plasma membrane to peel away from the cell wall. The cell wall still has a rigid shape pretty much. But you peel away that plasma membrane from the interior of the cell wall, and that will kill the cell. That is not, it's analogous to the animal cell shriveling, but this is not called crenation. It's called plasmolysis. The cell has plasmolyzed, but the process is called plasmolysis. And don't confuse plasmolysis, which has the lysis in it,
with lysis.
Lysis is caused by a totally different situation. Plants don't lyse. They like hypotonicity. Animal cells lyse in hypotonicity because they can't hold the pressure. Plant cells undergo plasmolysis, which is not because of hypotonicity, it's because of hypertonicity. They lose water. Is that all clear? All the definitions good? Anything not clear? Okay, well then let me talk a little bit about the report. First of all, you just finished one report, and you're starting another one before you've even had the other one graded. So that's one thing. Another thing is that you have a test in less than a week now, and that's what I want you to focus on. So you're going to get your data here today, and you're going to listen to me tell you how to make a graph, but after you leave, I want you to temporarily forget about this. Don't start working on this report before I grade the other one, for one thing, but also just don't even worry about it until after the first test. Even if I forget what I put as the due date, but I can move it if I have to. Do the test first. Focus on that first. But anyway, the report is different, of course, but it's still a matter of just answering whatever it asks for. The questions are different, of course, in this one. In this one, you have to make another graph, though. And, of course, in any graph, you have dependent versus independent, right? What is the independent variable today? The concentration, right, of the bathing solutions. What's the units? Molar, capital M. All right. And what are you measuring? What is the dependent variable? Well, you're measuring directly mass. You're measuring it twice, right? Those individual mass measurements are your raw data. That's what you directly obtain from the experiment. But you then use those to calculate change in mass. And you shouldn't be graphing mass, you should be graphing change in mass, which you have to calculate from your raw data. All right? In other words, each dish will have just one point, not two, because you're going to use those two masses to calculate a change in mass for that dish. In science, we often use the capital delta to denote change of something. So change in mass would be in units of grams. Well, mathematically, there's two ways to calculate a difference, right? The difference between A and B can be calculated as A minus B or B minus A. Which way is the correct way to calculate change in mass? Change in mass equals what? That's right. Mass final minus mass initial. The reason this is the correct way is think about the situation in which you end up with greater mass than you started. That means mass final is bigger than mass initial. A bigger number minus a smaller number is going to give you a positive number. So a positive change, a positive delta, means that it is increased. Whereas if you end up with a smaller number, that means you've lost mass. It's going to be smaller minus greater, which is going to be a negative number. A negative delta means a loss. And either of these is possible. And both are probable in your experiment because of how you set it up. Therefore, when you graph change in mass rather than mass, don't put zero down here because your values can be either positive, zero, or negative. Right? Zero should be somewhere in the middle of the axis. Does that make sense? That's not a line of best fit. That's just the zero line. Okay. Now to the part that this is just basic graphing, so that really wasn't anything new. But now I wanted to talk about the part that confuses the most people. And so I just am going to tell you the correct way to do it. Even though telling people the correct way to do it still results in people not doing it correctly. In one part of the report directions, though, it asks you to figure out what the concentration of starch in the potatoes is. And so this is confuses the hell out of people because, of course, you don't make any measurements on the potatoes about the concentration, right? You don't measure the concentration of anything. You start with different concentrations of bathing solution, the sugar solution, but that's already made up for you. You didn't measure any concentrations today, and you won't. So people say, well, how am I supposed to know if we don't make any concentration measurements? This goes all back to the definitions I just gave you about tonicity. Okay? You're measuring change in mass. Now, why would there be a change in mass? What would happen to cause a change in mass? Whether it's upward or downward. Right, osmosis. In other words, water can be added to the cells, or water can leave the cells. Either one of those is going to cause a change in mass. Okay? The question asks for what is the concentration of starch? Well, you don't have to make any measurements of starch to get this. What is the definition of isotonicity? That's right. An isotonic solution has the same solute concentration as the cell does. That's the key, because the question is asking you to figure out the solute concentration of the cell. That's involved in the definition of isotonicity. Okay? A solution is going to be isotonic for that cell only if it has the same solute concentration. And the solute concentration of that environment is your independent variable. Right? The X, in other words, of the graph. So you'll have, you know, it won't necessarily look like this, but you'll have three values. So let's just put them like this. Not on a perfect line, as you'd expect, because there's some error. But you can fit a line to that. Notice that none of these true data, the points themselves, is right on the zero line. But you can use the trend line to interpolate. It's this zero y value that matters. Zero y, zero change in mass, means isotonic, right? And that corresponds to a certain molar concentration of sugar, but not necessarily any of the three that you actually measured. I mean, that you actually used. That's why you use interpolation with the trend line to figure out what value of X, which is a molar concentration, exactly corresponds to zero in the Y axis, zero change in mass. Because this tells you that you would expect this concentration of sugar to be isotonic. And whatever that concentration of sugar is, by the definition of isotonicity, the potato has exactly the same concentration in it. Not of sugar, but of starch. It's the same wateriness, though. Does that make sense?
Say that again.
It's asking you to figure out what the concentration of starch is. That's another way of saying what is the solute concentration inside the potatoes. And you get that answer by figuring out what the concentration of an isotonic solution is. Because by definition of being isotonic, an isotonic solution has the same concentration as the cell. And an isotonic solution will give you no change in mass, because water is moving both in and out at the same rates. So it's just a matter of figuring out what x value, which is concentration, corresponds to a value in the y of zero change in mass. That's an isotonic concentration. And therefore, that's the same concentration as the potato has. That answers the question. That make any more sense? Yeah, tell me if it doesn't.
So, where you drew the line, that's the concentration of it, and zero is the isotonic part.
The interpolation part is that you have to go straight over from zero,
right,
and find where it hits the trend line.
Mm-hmm.
And then straight down to the x and read whatever value of x that is.
Right.
That means, even though you didn't test this x necessarily, mm-hmm, that concentration of sugar, if you bathed your potatoes in it, would give you no change in mass. And the only way that can happen is if that concentration of sugar is the same as the concentration of starch in the potato, which is what the question is asking for. What is the concentration of starch in the potato? You get at it indirectly by figuring out what an isotonic solution concentration is,
okay,
which is a zero change in mass.
When you find that isotonic concentration, you find the starch value.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Even though this is concentration of sugar, it's also the concentration of starch, because in the isotonic situation, they are equal.
Right. Okay.
Any other questions about the potato experiment? Okay, just make sure you use the same technique of allowing them to be wet to the same degree when you get the final measurements. You also have to just look at these things over here, and this also confuses a lot of people. You have strawberries here, you have raisins here. The problem is that people look at these strawberries and they think that there are two containers. Well, yes, in reality, there are two containers, but they're labeled before and after. So you're supposed to imagine this being the same container earlier and then later. There is one condition here, not two conditions. It's asking you to imagine the condition with respect to tonicity that would cause this to turn into this later. Okay, so think of it that way. As far as your packet is concerned, like I said, I want you to get everything done today, but kind of put it on the back burner then and concentrate on the test. As far as the packet is concerned, though, you only need to get through page 8 today. That includes, though, making a whiteboard drawing as a group. Each group has to make a whiteboard drawing. And don't leave before you have a picture of it. I'll approve it, and then you can, every member, take a picture. Because if you insert a picture of that whiteboard into your report once you write it, into the Word document, you can get extra points. All right? But here's what I want on the whiteboard. You have the three conditions that we talked about. Just draw one big potato cell, not many. One big cell, just like kind of like in the slide. And then you have three different kinds of symbols you need to use, because there are three different particles. One for water, and you use whatever symbols you want, like triangles, squares, whatever. But one of them is for water, one of them is for sucrose, and one of them is for starch. All right? And then draw them where they are in all three cases, and notice there's water inside and outside, but different concentrations. There is sucrose only in the two above zero concentrations, right? There's no sucrose at all in the zero. But in the other ones, sucrose is only outside of the cells. It can't get in. It wants to, but can't. There's starch inside the potato only in all three. So the only thing that can permeate is water. That's why it's osmosis. And so you need to show the concentrations by putting more water either in or out, depending on the situation, and then use arrows to indicate which direction it's going to move, and then label each one of them with its tonicity, either hypo, whatever. All right? Did I use almost an hour? Whatever I've used, it's time to go ahead and make your final measurements.